Welcome to all of you. Welcome back to those of you who were here yesterday and to those of you who have come today. It's been aware that, you know, whenever we go into a retreat environment, there's always a process of landing. And I think undertaking a retreat, whether it's a one-week retreat in silence or whether it's a one-day retreat, there's always a kind of psychological and emotional reorientation that's involved. You know, this is a time, a dedicated space, and actually it's quite phenomenal how we do manage to create these dedicated spaces in the most unlikely of environments. And that dedicated space is really, really born, I think, of a collective intentionality. The intentionality towards silence, the intentionality towards really embracing the practice, the intentionality of kindness and care that we take with one another. In a sense, we always create a retreat together. We don't do it alone. But a retreat is more than just a physical landing in a space like this. It is that kind of reorientation. And very often when people begin retreats, I would ask them to consider two questions. And one of those questions is, what would I really need to cultivate? What qualities or intentions would I need to cultivate to allow myself to be here most fully and most wholeheartedly? For some people, that is a cultivation of intention and dedication. For some people, it's a cultivation of patience, of kindness, of spaciousness. And the other question I think that is equally important is, what would I really need to let go of that would allow myself to be here most fully? And again, that there isn't a right answer to that question, and there may be very personal responses. But I think there's also often a kind of universality in those responses. And often what many people say they need to let go of is habit, the habit of busyness, the habit of preoccupation, the habit of planning, the habit of judgment, the habit of distractedness. And my own sense is that these questions are not only questions that apply to retreats, that if they apply to a retreat, it really is most likely that they also apply to the rest of our lives. And so they are worthy questions to consider. Yesterday we began the weekend really by exploring the understanding of what is meant by liberation in the teaching of the Buddha. And I think those two questions are not outside of the landscape of that investigation. Because those two questions of what is needed to cultivate, what is needed to relinquish, in a way they truly are in the service of liberating the moment, of awakening the moment, and really appreciating in a way that the sense of immediacy of that awakening and liberating the moment. There is so much of a kind of an inclination to really almost mystify and romanticize liberation, and I certainly don't want to underestimate in any way the profundity of the kind of inner freedom that the Buddha spoke about. But the Buddha also spoke about path and fruition. That, you know, liberation is not something we run into by accident at the bus stop for most people. It's not something we bump into in the context only of a sort of intensive retreat. the way that the Buddha very much presented this path is that it is a training of the heart. Not a training as, you know, don't think of kind of army boot camp or, you know, apprenticeship or something like that. But it is a training in awakening. There is a path and there is a fruition of that path. So this brings us again and again back to the moment that we are in and how we are present, how we are being present with our bodies, with our minds, with everything around us, with our emotional world. How are we actually present within all of this? And it's, you know, really appreciating the possibilities. We all know there's ways of being present without actually being particularly mindful or wakeful. You know, we can be very angry, we can be very resistant, we can be very judging, we can be very preoccupied. We're still present in those moments. We're simply not particularly awake to what's going on. So this path is not about kind of endlessly, you know, rearranging the contents of our experience, but looking at the quality of relatedness to that experience. Over the last year, I've been personally reflecting a lot on the quality of embodiment. And what my understanding of embodiment is. And I was kind of reflecting in its deepest sense how embodiment is almost a synonym for liberation. It's almost a synonym for nibbana. And when I first started reflecting on this idea, the possibility, the quality of embodiment, I turned first to the dictionary to actually look, what does the dictionary actually say about embodiment? And it talks about embodiment, or it defines embodiment as the tangible or visible expression of a quality, or a lived expression of a quality. And then it led me to reflect on how much this practice and this path is totally dedicated to embodiment. The tangible, the lived expressions of kindness, of insight, of compassion, of care, of mindfulness, that none of this is much use as a theory. None of this is much use as a good idea. It is only ever valuable as something that is lived. So then I went further, my own reflections, to think about, well, what does that actually mean in the context of this path, embodiment? And my own sense is that it's a kind of congruence. It's a kind of congruence, a kind of fruition, a congruence of aspiration, intention, and manifestation. That those three join together in a kind of seamless, naturalized continuum. And then as I thought about this a little bit more, it really occurred to me that to understand embodiment means having the willingness to investigate the discomfort of dissonance. The discomfort of dissonance. The places where our aspirations and our intentions and our manifestations really aren't knitted together in that seamless way. All of the places in body, speech, mind and life where there's a dissonance between our aspirations and intentions and the ways that we live, act, speak, and think. This is an interesting question. I think it's an uncomfortable question, But I don't think this teaching has ever really fled from discomfort. This teaching is not one that's particularly meant to console us or sedate us. It's really an encouragement to ask the important questions in a completely non-judgmental way. To look at the gaps. And, you know, I personally think that probably dissonance is something that's it's not outside of our awareness, is it? It's outside of anybody's awareness. I think it's a question of looking at the gaps and how often the gaps occur, but to be curious about those gaps and how frequently they occur. Have you ever had the kind of intention, you know, the aspiration, the intention most of us have to live and speak and relate with kindness and respect, and then, you know, almost just find ourselves, you know, thinking harshly of another or judgmentally, or in that wonderful phrase that I open my mouth and samsara jumps out, you know, that the words just kind of fly forth from somewhere clearly not in the realm of our intentions or what we most deeply value. You know, we might have the intention to sustain a practice. You know, we can see that here, you know, even on a microscopic level in our own daily practice on a retreat that, oh yes, you know, I've got this really good intention. You know, today's a day of continuity. You know, today's a day of sustaining practice. And then, you know, something more alluring comes along. Something more pressing, seemingly. You know, we can have the intention in the beginning of a sitting or a walking, you know, to really sustain our mindfulness within this present moment. And then, you know, out comes, you know, the first kind of enticing fantasy, and we just flee, you know. We find that our attention just flies. These gaps keep arising in our life, our longing for calmness and then finding ourselves practicing agitation, our longing for some kind of simplicity and restraint, but, you know, the second plate of food looks really good. Now, it is interesting. I mean, these are moments of forgetfulness, aren't they? They're moments of forgetfulness. We just kind of forget. We've forgotten what kind of where we truly wish to make our home. And, you know, part of mindfulness, and they're clearly moments that are not liberated. They're not awakened moments. They're really moments when we find ourselves most kind of held within the grip of the habitual, the impulsive, the compulsive. Now, And part of mindfulness, part of the definition of sati, of course, is remembering. Constantly nurturing our capacity to remember. And it's not only about remembering where we are, but it is a way of remembering those deepest values, those deepest aspirations, those deepest intentions that we truly wish to be the kind of guiding principles in our life. Because in a way we know that those intentions and aspirations are really kind of form the landscape of an awakened heart, an awakened mind. And, you know, to take into our own inquiry, you know, what does the mind of a Buddha actually look like? You know, what does a mind of a liberated mind actually look like? And I think probably one of the characteristics, you know, clearly deep transforming insight, but also this sense of congruence, this seamlessness of the naturalized fruition of that knitting together of intention, value, aspiration, and manifestation. As far as I can see from, you know, looking at the teaching, much of the teaching is concerned with healing dissonance, with understanding the gaps, understanding the places of dissonance, and actually really learning to heal them. But how we do that is incredibly important. Because often when people do meet these places of gaps, these places of dissonance, what is our first reaction to that? Is it one of saying, ah, a moment of forgetfulness, renew intention? Or is our response, or really rather reaction, to the awareness of those gaps, is to meet them with a sense of failure, a sense of judgment or blame? I'm not good enough to do this, you know. And the word again comes into our vocabulary with too much frequency. You know, I blew it again. You know, I lost it again. And we don't even appreciate how much the subtext of that word again is a kind of an inner scolding, an inner blaming, an inner judgment. And what we actually see, that the moment that we're kind of conditioned to meet dissonance with judgment and blame, the effect that it has is essentially to undermine energy, to undermine confidence, and to undermine a sense of aspiration and possibility. And of course, the very kind of difficult part of mindfulness practice is that it really does highlight what's going on within ourselves. So it was one thing before we ever began to even practice any quality of awakening to kind of lose it over and over again in our life. At least it wasn't within our portfolio of something kind of odd. You know, the moment that you begin to practice, and your kind of portfolio of aspiration expands, doesn't it? I mean, it's not just about getting through life in some sort of competent way. You actually have personal inner aspirations towards peace, towards compassion, towards kindness. And how easily that those qualities or those aspirations get kind of hijacked by this inner critical mind, this inner judgmental mind. And, you know, now it's bad enough that I sort of, you know, fell over my shoes in the doorway. And now, you know, I fell over my shoes in the doorway and I'm really such a mindless person. So our portfolio almost has got bigger. But there is a reality that as our capacity for wakefulness grows, so does too our capacity for discomfort. And our awareness of some of the discomfort that arises in the gap. But I think it is really important just to acknowledge that the mindfulness of the gaps between our intention and lived experience, the mindfulness of the places of dissonance in our life, is actually the beginning of every path of awakening. It is where we practice. It is where we learn to cultivate and almost to begin to approach these places of dissonance not as something negative, but as the creative tension of waking up. It's almost like, you know, we live with this reality that on one hand or on one side, we are again and again encouraged to plant the seeds of intention. And it's said that really the whole of this path rests upon the head of the pin of intentionality. Because intentionality is what takes us out of the field of impulse. But we have that encouragement to cultivate that intentionality, but intentionality also has roots. The roots of intentionality are around aspiration, around value, what we most deeply value, how we want to wish our lives to be guided, what we want to naturalize. But those aspirations and intentionality are sitting alongside the whole realm of emotional, psychological habit and impulsiveness and compulsions. Now, I think it is incredibly important to be able to recognize that and to be also remarkably forgiving and compassionate within that. Because if we really consider, most of us, we have a much longer history and far more excellence in training habit than we have in the practice of cultivated moment-to-moment applied intentionality. So this is the tension. And we actually see when the world of habit, emotional, psychological habit, is unattended to, first of all, it does just dominate our lives. But it really does lead very directly to that sense of imprisonment, that sense of being bound. And what we see the purpose of intentionality is there to do is actually to liberate the moment from the grip of the habits that are unhelpful to us, the emotional, psychological habits that are unhelpful to us. And this is not getting into a language of right and wrong, good and bad. But if we look at our own experience, we see there are many psychological, emotional habits that are simply unhelpful. You know, impatience, aversion, judgment, shame, blame, jealousy, all of these are simply unhelpful in that they lead to further contractedness. They lead to further distress and anguish. So, alongside recognizing that, it is also recognizing that habitual patterns arise in the moment. They are not static states. And I think the gift or the blessing of this teaching is to truly accept that just because something has a long history does not mean that it has an equally long future. The essence of the teaching of awakening the moment, is really seeing that the great gift of mindfulness is to be able to embrace the potential turning points of every moment. The potential turning points of every moment. This relies a lot upon the mindfulness to be able to see what is going on. It relies a lot upon developing the skillful means to meet whatever is arising in the moment. But to be able to see there are choices of being either able to feed the unhelpful, and our primary way of feeding the unhelpful is through thought, through clinging, through aversion, through resistance, we feed the unhelpful. Or learning actually to quite consciously nurture that which is helpful. And we probably have an inner awareness of what is helpful in this life, what is skillful. Inquiry, investigation, kindness, patience, compassion. Willingness to embrace, courage. All of these live within, as seeds within our own consciousness, within our own hearts. And in a sense, you know, the word in Pali, this word sadha, sometimes translated as faith, but I think more accurately, what do we actually set our hearts upon? Because what we set our hearts upon is actually what we set our attention upon. It's what we set our mindfulness upon. And in a sense, the potentiality of each moment raises that question of what do I set my heart upon in this moment? And there are ways of unconsciously setting our hearts upon the habitual, which actually just, you know, you feed something, it grows stronger. You know, you feed a pattern, it grows stronger. To set our hearts upon a sense of capacity, of mindfulness, of calm abiding, of compassionate attention, this too grows and develops. We're learning to embrace dissonance as, I think, really a creative tension. This is where we're truly beginning to explore what does it mean to liberate this moment? What does it mean to awaken this moment through really sensing what we are setting our hearts upon in this moment? Now, the training, I think it's important not to have an allergy to this word training. The training of meditation is actually a training in strengthening that intentionality capacity. When we bring our attention to being mindful of breathing, mindful of body, mindful of listening, this is all embodied intentionality. It is an embodied mindfulness. And moment to moment, that is actually illuminating and actually liberating the places where there's a more unconscious embodiment of habit. But we're learning to embody that intentionality, to have a lived expression of that quality. But that mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of listening, none of this is emotionally neutral. You know, I think there's too easily a tendency to see mindfulness as this one-dimensional word of paying attention. But this does not describe the kind of depth of mindfulness, which has this huge family. You know, mindfulness has a big family, close relatives, investigation, calmness, equanimity, energy, and joy. You know, there's too easily a sense, I think, particularly when the mind gets a little bit weighed down by an uncomfortable awareness of many gaps, that we approach this path as somehow work. You know, and I hear that word used, particularly in practice in this culture. You know, I'm working on something. It'd be very hard to find that in the early texts. And actually often the attitude in that work is really a little bit grim. You know, I've got to work on this, I'm working on my greed, you know, and then next week I've got anger on the menu, you know, and the week after that I've got jealousy on the menu. And the endlessness of the work. The endlessness of the work. But that idea of work is one that is giving tremendous weight to history in patterns, and in doing that also giving weight to future. I think much more instead in this path, the kind of attitudinal basis of sati, of present moment recollection, is always one that is imbued with the qualities, the family members of kindness, of patience, of compassion, of curiosity, of investigation, and of joy. And joy in that sense, in this sense, is not talked about as some, you know, high or some rapturous state, but the quiet joy of walking the path and knowing what it's in the service of, in the service of awakening, in the service of liberating the moment, in the service, in a real sense, of transforming the shape of our hearts, which does indeed transform the shape of our worlds. Okay, so the kind of outline of the day today is we'll take the time for sitting, for walking, take some time for some questions before lunch for anyone who wishes. This afternoon we'll continue with some practice and a Dharma talk, and also some time at the end for any reflections or questions that have arisen. But I think most of us know that, you know, the very first step in any day of retreat, no matter how long or how short the retreat is actually to cultivate inwardly some calm abiding and some brightness of mind and heart. So before we begin the sitting, if it's helpful for you to stand up just for a minute to have a stretch, please do so. And if you find yourself feeling a little dull or heavy, a few arms up above the head, it's often a good thing. About wiping out your neighbor. Those first moments in a formal sitting that are so important to actually pay attention to and to take care of your body and your body in whatever posture you're in. To lengthen your spine a little without forcing, but feeling that sense of uprightness, of alertness in your posture. Letting your head rest in a wakeful, relaxed position on the top of your spine. And just really turning your attention to the life of your body in this moment. Places where there's discomfort. Places where there's ease. Mindful of the aliveness within your body. Spectrum of sensations that arise and pass. The very process of the body. Body as process. Your attention to listening wholeheartedly, not focusing so much on the sounds, but just as a capacity to listen, to receive. Mindful of your mind, heart in this moment, whatever thoughts, images, emotional states are present, simply knowing, establishing that intentional mindfulness. feeling the body, breathing, cultivating that calm abiding in the midst of the changes, the thoughts, the sensations and sounds. And inner resting within mindfulness of the body breathing. Being equally receptive to all the moments of departure, bringing the same calm abiding. To know a thought is a thought, a sound is a sound. sensitive to the moments your mindfulness may drift or wander. Aware that intentionality is something renewed moment to moment. activity in meditation is a form. The walking practice is a form. Now clearly these forms are never meant to be ends in themselves. They are meant to be really the skillful means within which we cultivate the qualities of heart and mind that really incline the mind towards understanding. The sitting meditation is a place where often one really senses the possibility of developing a deeper calm abiding. And there is a very direct relationship, I think, in most people's practice between that calm abiding and development of and real deepening or naturalizing of understanding. As I mentioned yesterday, many people today coming into practice, you know, have a wealth of understanding learned from their own lives about what leads to struggle and confusion and what leads to its end. And part of the dissonance we often encounter is seeing the gap between that understanding and how it's actually lived and applied. And sometimes there's that frustration of, I know this. Why doesn't it make any difference? You know, and I think that there's many, many factors in that. But I think part of the relationship between calm abiding and insight is that calm abiding really allows the mind heart to be settled enough, still enough, that many of those understandings which are not new to us really have the opportunity to almost sink into the bones, to actually make a difference. And for many people, you know, life is so frequented by busyness, not just as a number of things we do, but busyness as a state of mind. It's almost as if that busyness inclines the mind towards impulse and reactivity. And I don't think this would be a surprise to anyone in their life. So the sitting practice has that capacity to really begin to deepen in that calm abiding, to see more clearly, you know, what is actually going on, how it can be responded to. And yet there's a certain completion, I think, to this picture that comes through the walking practice, a practice which many people demote in their hierarchy of meditation values. You know, I've got the sitting, that's the real stuff, and I've got filler, which is the walking, you know, or the poor cousin, which is the walking. It's a very unfortunate kind of hierarchy system which really doesn't serve us well, because the majority of our time in our lives is not spent on a cushion. It is spent interfacing with the world of sights and sounds and movement and experience and events. And actually the walking practice is such a training for actually learning that it's possible to develop that calm abiding in the midst of those events. What we actually see is that when the body moves into activity, the mind very often moves into a momentum activity, of activity, which may or may not be necessary. Which may be at times necessary, but overutilized. I mean, you know, this year and last year when I was teaching in a non-residential retreat in a university setting, you know, it's pretty noticeable that educational establishments tend to have every wall papered with information, you know, signs, notices, you know. And one person came out and they said to me that, you know, almost every walking period they'd spent reading all the notices. So they knew everything about an apartment they had no interest in moving into. They knew everything about a course they had no intention of ever taking. They knew about people's, you know, course, you know, what they're signed up for, their curriculums. And they said it was just so remarkable just to watch themselves in every walking period sort of enacting and embodying that kind of hunger. That almost the hunger for food, almost a kind of hunger for distractedness, a hunger for something to be preoccupied with, even in the moments when, of course, it was completely uncalled for. I mean, fortunately, they were really able to really see this without any extra layer of you know, judgment or aversion or blame. But in the walking practice, and I think one of the great values of the walking practice is that it really, really does provide so much opportunity to explore this realm of impulse, which can be such a governing factor in our lives. It's almost like our eyes are open and we start looking for something to look at, you know, or our ears come to life and we're looking for something almost. And how much of that is often almost a kind of this very strange kind of contradictory impulse where we're longing for stillness and the habit of almost the habit of insufficiency seems to take us into the world of endlessly searching for something to kind of camouflage stillness. It is a curious paradox in our life. I mean, you know, we see, you know, how that comes to life in the walking practice, you know, because you see, you go out into the walking path. I mean, it's pretty much an open opportunity, isn't it? We can just walk. We can feel the body walking. We can feel the body touching the ground. We can see the sights that are coming to us, listen to the sounds that come, and to the space in between. But how often we see how the sense doors are almost being primed by habit, aren't they? Being primed by the habit to be on the prowl. You know, the kind of more mind, you know, more sight, you know, more, what can I look at? You know, what can I kind of do here? And I think that the great gift of the walking practice is really developing this capacity to calm the appetite, to calm that kind of hunger. It's a hunger of insufficiency. It's a hunger of a sense of lack, which often kind of sends the sense doors out into the world almost as being servants of that hunger. And that there's quite a different way that the sense doors, our eyes, our ears, our bodies, our minds, touch, can be utilized. That there can be so much in the service of appreciation, of receptivity, of developing stillness, of developing calmness, of developing connectedness, rather than in the service of that more habitual pattern of busyness, agitation, and wanting more. So as you go out into the walking period, you know, I really encourage you to explore this, because this is probably one of our kind of bigger places of dissonance. You know, where that deep longing for stillness, for inquietude, for appreciation, and yet the way that gets kind of undermined by the habitual pattern of being always on the prowl, or the culture of lack manifested through the sense doors. So finding a walking path for yourself, I mean, again, we are so fortunate here to have a little green, a little space, and a little ground to find a walking path for yourself and really feel what it is to actually stay with the path. You know, and it's almost like how much the physical path is just that metaphor for staying with that path of intentionality. And also being aware that this is, you know, the big difference between intentionality and New Year's resolutions, which are very rarely successful, is that intentionality is always asking for a renewal. It's always asking for renewal. That forgetfulness is met not with judgment, or disconnection, but that moments of forgetfulness are met with that willingness to renew intentionality.